It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. When a writer says she has a food story from France, you don't really expect it to be from Calais, in a refugee camp built on a landfill.
Hamada is Sudanese. He's a young man. The Sudanese community is really interesting because communal sharing is an important aspect of Sudanese culture. So the second day I was there, they said, why don't we cook for you? So I said, okay, I'll go to the grocery store and get the food. And so Hamada and I drove to what they call a hypermarché, which is the French equivalent of a Costco.
That's Shane Mitchell, author of Far Afield. We'll hear more from her and other stories of food in faraway places, from lush Hawaii to the unexpected rise of London as a culinary capital, this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. So if you're the kind of person who travels to eat, you probably don't end up vacationing much in very touristy places like Hawaii, where the tourist industrial complex sets it up so you leave the resort beach as little as humanly possible. You know, you wake up, you get your Eggs Benedict, you have a couple of tiki drinks at dinner, and a week later, you've got a great tan, but barely remember what you ate. You have dined on the cuisine of nowhere. But of course, Hawaii food goes way deeper than that. And so we wanted to talk to Sheldon Simeon today, a proud Filipino son of Hawaii and a finalist on Top Chef Charleston. Chef, great to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I'm stoked to be here.
So first of all, congratulations on all your success on Top Chef. And I actually want to ask you a question that occurred to me while I was watching the show. And there was a moment that struck me. It was actually before we got to the finale and all that. And there was an episode where the challenge was for you to reflect on the time you spent cooking in Charleston. And what you said was that the experience made you feel like you understood yourself more as a cook from Hawaii. So what does it mean for you to be a cook from Hawaii?
For me, it means that we grew up in such a paradise that is so unique, where it is about the people, it is about the community, and how we're connected to our environment and our land. And it just made me appreciate how special Hawaii is, being so far away from home. Mm-hmm. The feeling in Charleston is very much like that. It's all about taking care of your neighbor, taking care of the ingredients that feed your family. And it really touched me in that way. And I got to be able to kind of relax and be myself in that environment and cook my food.
And your food seems very personal to you. I've never had the opportunity to eat it, but just watching it on TV for week after week after week, it seems very personal to you. It seems very tied to not just your own story, but to the story of your neighbors and the people you know in Hawaii. So what is Hawaii food?
Hawaii food is all these layers of basically immigrants or people who came to live in Hawaii. And it dates back all the way to the Polynesian voyagers that came up from the Marquesas who first settled in Hawaii. And then the years that followed, the history of World War II playing a part in there. And then the hugest, probably biggest influence is the immigration of plantation workers. Mm-hmm. So Japanese field workers, Filipino, Portuguese, Chinese, all of that all coming together, bringing their food and then kind of creating like this cuisine that all seamlessly blends together.
Yeah. So what are some of the dishes where, like, if you're Hawaiian, you're like, oh yeah, that's ours?
The saimin, which is our version of ramen, which is a saimin noodle, very much like ramen. They use egg in it, so it has a little bit more body. Mm-hmm. The broth is very clean. It's pork-based, a little bit of seafood in it. Very simple, usually just like green onions, maybe some char siu roast pork and some fish cake, but that's it. It's not over the top like how ramen is, but as you can see, it's like a blending of like three different cultures into one and becomes a delicious bowl.
Like which influences?
So Chinese in there with the char siu pork. The broth of like Portuguese in there too. Filipino with like pancit noodles, kind of that style with egg noodles. That's all coming together.
That's cool. So, Hawaii, I've never been. Well, my mother keeps telling me she took me.
We gotta get you out there, Fred.
I'd love to, man. But my mother tells me she took me when I was in the womb. So I'm like, thanks, Ma. Yeah, it doesn't really count, but thank you very much. But so for a long time, the cliche was, you know, people didn't really think of Hawaii as a great place for food. Like you had this tropical paradise and obviously the pineapple and the, you know, all the tropical fruits. But so much of the food was imported from the mainland, and so much what people ate was just kind of hotel food that was geared toward tourists. Has that changed?
We feel that it hasn't changed, but we're changing it. Just over 100 years ago, Hawaii was a fully sustainable island. We're the most isolated landmass, you know, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So it's crazy to think that we import everything there. The food was based off of what everyone sees. It needs to be tropical. So there's always, everyone thinks that there's pineapple on everything or papayas or whatever. Again, the food's much more deeper than that. Talk about like vegetables on the island. Like my grandparents, Filipinos, they never went to the market. They always had their Filipino garden in the back. And we always used to go pick vegetables in the back there. The Hawaiians had this system, this ahapua'a, which is a system that is segregated land from the ocean all the way up to the mountain, and everything working together in this kind of cycle. And it was very much about being sustainable. Tourism came in. We needed to get materials and ingredients, and it kind of just evolved that way, how everything just kind of started to get imported into Hawaii.
And so I remember reading about a number of chefs who in the early 90s, you know, were proud of this idea of they call Hawaii regional cuisine. They were chefs like Roy Yamaguchi and Sam Choi and Beverly Gannon and Alan Wong. And there was like a scene, and I feel like people were sort of into that idea of, you know, working with the traditions of Hawaii that had been there for many years and working with those ingredients. And but that was in the 90s. And I kind of feel like that attention sort of went away for a while. And now I feel like, oh, it seems like there's a new generation of young chefs who are kind of picking up that torch. I feel like there's you, there's Chris Kajioka, who at a restaurant, Sania, in San Francisco. There's definitely Ravi Kapoor, and I love that. Simeon, Kajioka, Kapoor, three names from Philippines, Japan, and India. And they're all representing this new Hawaii cuisine. So why do you think there's this new energy? What are you guys doing that's different than what they were doing in the 90s?
I think the idea of the new chefs is that we are thinking about our community first and the food that feeds our community. We are taking a step back and doing the food that our grandmothers and our aunts and our uncles all cooked, and the food that we grew up eating, and putting it out there instead of trying to do, you know, something with French influence with some type of Hawaii flavor, and or trying to put a spin on Hawaii food with French technique. No, we're cooking food straight up. Kajioka has like the best cooking technique I've ever seen in my life. But still, yeah, the food's soulful. The food's, again, inspired by his mother, by his the Sunday dinners. Chef Ravi, he's throwing Spam. He's making Spam from scratch on the menu in San Francisco. Who knew at this time and age that that's what you'd be seeing in a menu in San Francisco?
Yeah.
And I'm looking for inspirations from Hongan-ji's, like the Japanese churches, like cookbooks in the 1980s that were made from like mochi pounding grandmothers. And I'm going to auntie's house and learning how they make their adobos and all that. And that's where the inspiration is. And then the whole farm to table thing. We're super connected. My best friends are all farmers. And not just because of the business or whatever. It's just that's my family. That's my community. And I'm going to support that. And I think that's how the food is in Hawaii with these new chefs.
Yeah. Like you said, it comes back to take care of your community. Thank you so much for coming today.
Oh, my pleasure, man. It's awesome. I get to be here in the Big Apple. Share a little bit of the aloha spirit, man. Thank you for that.
Aloha. Sheldon Simeon is chef owner of Tin Roof Restaurant in Maui and is a two-time finalist on Top Chef. And you can find a Hawaii-influenced recipe from Lynn and Sally that was inspired by a legendary staff trip there years ago, North Shore Shrimp Scampi, on splendidtable.org. You know, hearing Sheldon talk about the richness of Hawaii, it seems like such an obvious place to have a vibrant cuisine because, you know, all the ingredients are there, right? Like you have this fantastic climate and rich soil and all these different cultures that have come there. But it also made me think of the cuisine of the Faroe Islands because the Faroes are pretty much the opposite of Hawaii. Smack dab between Iceland and Norway, it's a country of just 50,000 people, almost all descendants of Vikings who landed there over 1,000 years ago, and they're all quick to tell you that there are more sheep than people. And it is one of the most beautiful places I have ever been. It's this vastness of sky and sea, but there's also this intense feeling that anywhere you can lay your eyes on, you can just get up and walk to. It's a magical feeling. It's almost like you're just floating above the earth. And it was summer when I was there a few years ago, which is to say it was 50 degrees, but brilliantly, just incredibly green, glowing neon green. But for all their intense green and beauty, the Faroes are one of the most barren places I've ever been. Back in the 1600s, I believe, a Danish priest moved there and wrote home about it. He wrote, "Countries are praised for their great wealth, several metals, minerals, precious stones, pearls, wine, and grain. But all this God denied the Faroes." Which is really cold coming from a priest. But it's a crazy environment. And so, you know, potatoes are about the only thing that people try to grow there. And most of the traditional food is basically just a subsistence diet of fish or lamb, fresh or mostly air-dried. Those potatoes, like birds if you can get them, and maybe their eggs, and some medicinal herbs that grow in the warm months. But there are hardly any vegetables, no fruit to speak of, and not even salt. Because if you think about it, it doesn't get enough sun to really evaporate seawater into salt. And yet, when I was there, I met a chef named Leif Sorensen, who was kind of single-handedly inventing a fine dining cuisine of the Faroe Islands. In his restaurant, I had this unreal tasting menu. He knew one man on the islands who was growing turnips in his dad's yard, and for some magical reason they tasted, I swear to God, like pears and cantaloupes. So I had turnip juice that tasted like pears and cantaloupes to go with my dinner. And I had this insanely fat mussel with seaweed smoke, and I had the sweetest langoustine ever, which he'd seasoned with dried seaweed instead of salt. And underneath each dish was a story of how hard life had to work to make this cuisine out of almost thin air. The Faroe Islands have some of the best seafood in the world, but life couldn't get local fish in his restaurant because all the seafood vendors are geared for export. So he asked his dad to go out and fish for him. And he could serve me that mussel because he happened to know a guy who was a construction worker on a bridge who like looked down one day into the water and was like, "Hey, there's some shells there." And he went diving for them. And he was like, "Oh my God, what is this thing?" And life is, "That's a mussel, that's a mussel." And he got so excited, he ran over to the prime minister's house, knocked on his door, and started lobbying him to change the laws so they can serve local shellfish. And just like that, he invented a Faroese shellfish industry. But he couldn't get enough people to work in the restaurant with him. So he was serving the tables while running the kitchen the night I was there. And his sous chef was actually an old protege of his who was at home for vacation from his real job cooking in Copenhagen. And honestly, a lot of his neighbors didn't get it because they can get imported food now in the Faroes in a grocery store. So they don't understand why life wants to cook Faroese food. Or on the other hand, people were like, "Oh, what? Like our food isn't good enough for you? You have to go make it fancy?" And his cousin came in for dinner once and laughed at the portions. When the server came to bring his dish, he said, "Oh, don't go anywhere." And he ate the whole thing with one swipe of his fork and just handed him the plate back. But through all of this, life keeps working and kept inventing and kept finding new foods in his tiny home country. And he eventually left the restaurant, but his protege decided to move home to the Faroes and stay, and he took over. And just earlier this year, the Michelin guide, France's old line arbiter of taste, came and gave the restaurant a star. It had made the news all over Scandinavia. The Faroe Islands, where so little grows, has won one of the most coveted awards in food. And so, you know, cuisines are always built on the happenstances of history, culture, environment, climate. But sometimes, every once in a while, they're built on the vision of just one person. Amazing. Coming up, hospitality in a refugee camp, and poaching eggs with Bridget Lancaster of America's Test Kitchen. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. Journalist Shane Mitchell has toured the globe, filing reports for magazines like Saveur and Travel and Leisure. Her food stories from remote places have inspired her to take a closer look, not just at what people eat around the world, but how they share it with each other. Shane's book, Far Afield, is the result of more than 10 years of stories and is a stunning look at the meaning of hospitality around the world. Our contributor, Shauna Seaver, found out more.
Hi, Shane. Thanks so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Well, I have to say that the book is really stunning. I mean, just the look of it and the scope and the depth is really impressive. And the focus is food, but also hospitality. So I'm curious to know, what is it about that connection or what you had seen in these different parts of the world that made you feel like there was a book there to be written?
Well, hospitality is a universal construct. It plays out in many different ways through multiple cultures, but it's something that we all have a respect for. In fact, the definition of hospitality is the kind and generous reception of guests or strangers. And in my case, a lot of people welcome me to the table. And so the book is sort of an expression of that welcome in many, many communities.
In the introduction, you describe yourself and the audience for the book is having an appetite for the map's void spaces, which I love. And it perfectly describes just how far-flung the locations in this book are. You visit 10 very remote, very different parts of the world on nearly every continent. And I'm curious to know, was there any sort of driving thought that sort of propelled you through the process of making this book?
Yes, actually. There's an African proverb that is one of my favorites, and I think it's poignant. If I may, I think you might enjoy it too. It is, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together.
That is beautiful. Now, your chapter on Calais and your time you spent in this area you called the jungle, can you please tell us about that?
Well, we're all pretty aware right now of the refugee crisis. Mm-hmm. And it was starting to really reach critical mass over a year ago in Europe. It wasn't really being reported much here in the U.S. But James Fisher, the photographer, he and I were actually originally going to do a chapter on an elderly couple in the mountains north of Sarajevo. They are Bosnian. And during the Bosnian War, they actually were sheltering Muslims on their farm who were being persecuted. And it just seemed like a lovely story. It's a love letter to this couple, and James and I were going to go film them for the book, and he disappeared on me. I didn't know where he was for months, and he wasn't answering his phone, and he wasn't answering texts or emails. I was like, where are you? And he surfaced one day and said, look, I'm really sorry. I know we were supposed to go to Bosnia, but I'm here in northern France with this group of refugees, and it's a really terrible situation. Get on a plane. You've got to come here. And that's how I wound up in Calais, which is in northern France, which is where the channel between England and France exits on the French side. And there was a huge camp that had developed on a toxic landfill of refugees from all over the crisis area who had wound up here, and they were desperately trying to get to the UK for asylum.
Your guide in this chapter, if I can call him that, his name is Hamada, I loved the story of you going to the supermarket with him. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, gosh, yes. Okay, so Hamada is Sudanese. He's a young man from a region that's been in great conflict. So he left and made his way through Libya and got to Italy and then ultimately wound up in Calais, which is where we met him. The Sudanese community is really interesting because they are really accustomed to working together and sharing meals. And just communal sharing is an important aspect of Sudanese culture. So the second day I was there, they said, why don't we cook for you and celebrate you being here? So I said, okay, I'll tell you what, I'll go to the grocery store and get the food. Just let me know what you need. And so Hamada and I drove to the local version, what they call a hypermarché, which is the French equivalent of a Costco. So Hamada and I are wandering through this huge supermarket. You know, my French is mediocre. His French is non-existent. He speaks pretty good English. I speak no Arabic. Well, except for please and thank you. But we're wandering through looking for the ingredients for a particular dish that they want to cook, which is called malarop, which is a type of yogurt and lamb stew. But we're wandering around the supermarket, and Hamada says, we need this type of bean. We can't find what he wants. He's just like, I know it when I'll see it. And he said, if we don't get it, it's okay. You know, he was just so accommodating. I said, all right. So we didn't find the beans. And we're pushing our cart towards the checkout, and we just randomly go through the aisle where all the jams and jellies are kept. And he stops dead in the aisle, and he points, and he says, that's it. That's it. That's the bean. And I'm looking at where he's pointing, and what it is a jar of Skippy peanut butter. And we bought it.
I love that. I love it. We all know that recipe that works with you need the one particular thing. And it's such an iconic sort of product, especially for us in America, and for the two of you to have that moment of connection over something so simple. I think for me really defined what this whole book is about. And given everything that's happening in our world right now and your choice to connect with refugees on this level, it was very powerful. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about their commitment to keeping their food traditions and sense of hospitality alive despite their circumstances.
Well, for me, this chapter was very poignant. It was a very difficult place. It was traumatic to see people living in this sort of condition and in this sort of heightened anxiety and desperation. And yet their sense of hospitality was so poignant to see, even though they had, you know, the smallest amounts of food and the simplest, they were still so welcoming and they still wanted to even just offer a cup of tea. And I think what was really important for me is to emphasize that these are the people who were far afield at that point, not me. These were people who had fled their homes, had left war and persecution and terror behind, and almost with nothing but the clothes on their back, their children in their arms, and yet they wound up here and were so open to me and so generous to me. And for me, that's the personification of hospitality. What I asked them was, what is it that you remember from home? What is it that you can take from home that makes you feel better on this journey? And by and large, what most people replied was memories of their food from home, which is why the Sudanese were cooking me the dishes that they remember from home that they used to celebrate guests. So I think that's pretty much what was important to me about that chapter and what it says about people who are displaced, who have had all sorts of difficulties and yet can still welcome you into their hearts and open doors to you.
Shane, thank you so much for talking with us.
Shauna, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Shane Mitchell is the author of Far Afield, Rare Food Encounters from Around the World. Shauna Seaver's latest book is Real Sweet. We have a recipe for moula robe, that Sudanese lamb and yogurt stew from Shane's book, and you can find it at splendidtable.org. You can also find an extended podcast version of Shane's interview there. Put an egg on it. That's a mantra of magazines and restaurants, and it's been a mantra of magazines and restaurants for a few years, but the rest of the world has been doing it for centuries, and for good reason. An egg is a protein, it's a sauce, it can make a simple bowl of noodles or grains into a velvety, beautiful bowl of dinner. And cooking eggs is simple, but to do it perfectly is an art. Our managing producer, Sally Swift, sat down with Bridget Lancaster of America's Test Kitchen to learn about one of the holy grails of egg cooking, the perfect poach.
Hey, Bridget, great to have you here.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So I got a text message the other day from my 16-year-old asking me how to poach an egg. And I found myself stymied about how to tell her how to really do it. It's those simple things that we should know. And guess what? They're kind of hard.
Well, okay, first of all, kudos to your teenager for asking how to poach an egg.
It was an aberration, believe me.
It's one of those things, you're right, we should all know how to make very basic eggs, fried eggs, hard-boiled, soft-boiled, and poached eggs. A perfect poached egg has a nice, creamy, still a little bit runny yolk. We want that. We don't want that to overcook. And then the egg white around it is soft, pillowy, still very tender, but it doesn't have that ring of undercooked white that so often you find around poached eggs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there are all kinds of fables out there about swirling the water and adding vinegar, and some people love to microwave. What did you guys discover?
We tested them all. Yeah, we tested that vortex, the swirling water.
Mm-hmm.
We found that it was really hard to do more than two eggs at a time for that to be reliable. We also tried cooking them in muffin tins, you know, little individual ones.
Mm-hmm.
And the whites were nice and neat. It almost looked kind of like fast food eggs when they came out. They were so neat.
Egg McMuffin.
Right. but the outsides set way faster before the yolks were cooked through. And we also tried vinegar, which is, you know, something that people have been doing for generations. And the reason why actually makes sense, because it lowers the pH of the water. And that causes the egg whites to set at a lower temperature. That's key, because egg whites traditionally will set at a higher temperature unless you lower the pH of the water that it's cooking in.
Okay. And what did you discover to be the optimal technique?
The perfect poached eggs every single time relies on a really kind of a strange piece of equipment, and that's a colander, you know, just a fine mesh colander that you'd use to drain pasta.
And that's colander?
Right. Got to get the spaghetti out first. You crack the eggs into the colander, and anytime you crack an egg into any bowl, you'll find that the egg white is kind of two different textures. You have that thicker white that surrounds the egg yolk, and then outside of that, you have this really liquidy, watery egg white, and that's because as eggs age, they start to get more and more watery. So it's good to start with fresh eggs, because they'll have more of that thicker egg white, and then by cracking them into a colander, you can crack four at a time, and let them just drain for 20, 30 seconds, all that really watery egg white will just flow right away.
Hmm. And then you pop them in boiling water, steeping water. Where do you go from there?
So you want to transfer the eggs to a measuring cup, a liquid measuring cup. It's going to make it easy to put them in the water. And we put them in 6 quarts of boiling water, so a big Dutch oven or a stock pot's great. Add the vinegar, a little bit of salt too. That helps to not only season the eggs, but helps the whites to set. And once the water is boiling, you slip the eggs one by one into the water, a little space between them, put the lid on the pot, and then turn off the heat. So the heat from the water and from the pot, and of course the lid's keeping that heat inside, that's enough residual heat that's going to gently poach those eggs perfectly in just 3 minutes.
Wow, and so you're really just steeping them.
Right. That's absolutely right. You're just steeping them. And since you're not boiling them, you don't have to worry about them tattering or going all over the place or egg yolks really cracking open. So it's pretty foolproof.
Huh, that sounds great and simple. So beyond starting a brunch service at home, what tell me other ways that you like to use poached eggs.
Well, that's the beauty of poached eggs. Once you learn how to make them, you'll find that just about everything can be a lot better and a lot tastier with egg yolk in it. I love them over grits, cheese grits with a poached egg on top. Mm-hmm. You crack open that egg yolk, let that run through. I've even put them in tacos, put them in a burrito. I love them on a pizza, slice of pizza or a tostada, something like that. Yeah, pretty much I'd eat them out of my hand.
It's pretty much an instant sauce when you think about it.
It is. Yeah, that's a perfect way to put it.
Hey, Bridget, thanks for filling us in.
Thanks, Sally. Great to be here.
Bridget Lancaster is host of America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country. You can find their recipe for perfect poached eggs at splendidtable.org. Coming up, I get to talk with you. So give us a call, 1-800-537-5252, or find us on Twitter or Facebook, or you can email us at contact@splendidtable.org. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. All right, now I get to talk with you. Give us a call, 1-800-537-5252, or find us on Facebook or Twitter or email us, contact@splendidtable.org. Hey, Emily's on the line. How are you?
Hi, Francis. I'm good.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Denver, Colorado.
Oh, yeah. God, I love Colorado.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, the mountains are just so unreal there. Anyway, I'm sure you did not call to hear me, like, go off into a daze about how much I want to be in the mountains right now, but what would you like to talk about?
Well, my boyfriend recently went hunting down in Texas, and he brought back a bunch of pheasant, chucker, and quail, and I would just like some tips on how to prepare it and, you know, what spices go best with it.
Mm. Did he bring back the whole birds, or was it in parts, or are they just, like, field-dressed?
Right now, they just sort of look like frozen, vacuum-sealed blobs, but I did try to sort of experiment with the pheasant, and so it's breast meat, and then the breastbone is intact, and the wishbone is also intact. So what I've already done, I sort of, with a paring knife, pulled the breast meat away from the bone and marinated it in, like, some yogurt and preserved lemon, and then just treated it like a small chicken breast, sautéed it, and then, I don't know, roasted it for a little bit. And it was good, but it was just really dry, I guess. Mm. I don't know if I overcooked it or if, like, the pieces were just different sizes.
Mm.
So, I don't know. I think the quail is bone-in, and I think the chucker is also bone-in.
Okay. So I grew up in New Jersey and have not had the pleasure of doing much hunting in my life. However, a friend of mine who also grew up in New Jersey and is an extraordinary hunter is a dude named Hank Shaw. And he has written a blog for many years called Hunter, Gardener, Angler, Cook. And he is just a terrific person to look to. He actually has his blog really well set up. He has, like, great indexes of different recipes for all the different birds and animals. And he also has a book called Duck, Duck, Goose. And he has a second book, or maybe a third book, I think, called Buck, Buck, Moose, which is, like, totally worth buying just for the genius of that title alone. So he is a great resource. I would say, though, I think the thing to remember in cooking really most any kind of game is that typically these are animals, if they're in the wild, they have usually very little fat, the birds. Things like, you know, goose and duck, you know, have a more sort of protective layer of fat usually. But, like, the small birds, like pheasant and quail and chucker, like you're talking about, are usually pretty lean, a lot of muscle. And so that means they will be easy to overcook. They can get dry. And those birds in particular have a very sort of light, sort of like chicken-like flavor, as opposed to something like a, you know, squab that has like a darker meat. They'll have like a sort of, you know, kind of like a meatier flavor that I love. But the little birds are also great. I would just say when you're cooking them, I mean, when you're like, hey, I don't know what to do with them, but I marinate in yogurt and preserve them, I'm like, you totally have this. Like, I can't do anything for you because you totally know what you're doing. But I would say, yeah, I would cook them a little more lightly. So they're very much like chicken breast, but I would say you're fine cooking them to more like a medium kind of temperature, okay, where they have just a little bit of pink, almost like if you would do like a pork loin or something like that, like,
yeah,
if you don't mind a little bit of pink, that will really help with the okay texture. And in terms of different flavorings and seasonings, I think of like, oh, if you want to sort of accent a little bit of their woodsiness, you know, I think mm-hmm things like thyme, rosemary, juniper, if you like that flavor. Maybe a little shot of gin if you don't want to go get juniper berries. Like, you know, that can sort of bring those floral flavors. Maybe a touch of caraway. Like, I think of those kinds of flavors that, like, remind you of the forest as being really great pairings for something like a wild bird.
Okay, awesome. And then would you also recommend sort of searing them and then just maybe roasting them a little bit less time or, like, at a lower temperature?
Yeah, you can totally do that. I would also say, like, if they're really small, maybe not even do the oven, you know, do it like okay a nice medium heat in the pan just until it's cooked through. Don't worry too hard about getting like a really hard, like gorgeous sear on it, because by the time you get that, if they are really small, like you said, they might overcook. So go for more of like the gentle cooking, really sort of focus on the tenderness and sort of like its sort of natural, sort of subtle sweet flavor, and not okay stress too much about like, oh, getting that like macho sear.
Okay.
Our managing producer, Sally Swift, had a dear friend who would go hunting a lot. And she would tell me that her friend would just show up with like a cooler full of birds. And and she's
That's
like, you know, they're really lean.
To me.
Yeah. And she's like, and the way she always would do them, like she tried all these different methods. And finally, what she ended up becoming sort of a ritual for her, I guess, was use a lot of fat, because she said they're so lean. So butter
right
or bacon. Get in your onions, your garlic, your aromatics. Get in some nice stock and some wine and just braise them until they're tender and they sort okay of like start to fall off the bone, and serve them with pasta and know that there's going to be bones in them. So it's sort of like a rustic hands-on kind of eating.
Okay.
And just, you know, go with it. Go primal with it.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Thank you so much.
Sure. Enjoy it.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Cool. Thanks for calling. So we have Amy on the line. Hey, Amy, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I do a lot of cooking ahead. I work full time, so I like to prepare food that I freeze. And I always do chicken thighs in a big mm-hmm pot. So when I'm done cooking, then I have a lot of liquid left over. I pour that into the mason jars, and I save the liquid for soup.
Oh, yeah.
But I always have a lot of chicken fat left over. And I never really know what I could do with chicken fat. Besides, I use it to saute vegetables, and sometimes I make a bird seed to put outside. But I was wondering if it's okay to use for baking.
Oh.
And what to do with chicken fat.
Yeah, I mean, you are in a great place, because chicken fat is one of nature's gifts to mankind.
Okay.
But actually, back up for a second. When you say you do the chicken thighs in a pot, do you like simmer or boil them in water, and then you have like broth, and then the fat floats on top, or do you what the fat looks
sure
like?
Sure, I just put all of the chicken in a big pot, and I simmer it on the stove. I don't use any water; it doesn't need any water.
Oh, just in its own juice.
Yeah.
So that liquid has got to be super, super delicious and super flavorful.
It's great for soup. Yeah.
So and then afterwards, you like let it chill in the refrigerator, and you skim off the fat.
Right. Yep.
That's great. So if you skimmed off that fat is going to be pretty pure.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say if you want to use it for baking, well, first of all, it's, you know, that fat has a really sort of distinctive and intense and pretty savory flavor. So
mm-hmm
if you want to use it for baking, I would say, I'm not an expert baker, I have to confess, but I would say for most things that if you want to use butter for or oil, You could probably use that fat, but keep in mind it's going to have that flavor. So I would say to start with something like something savory, like corn muffins. I could see it being really delicious if you sort of use that in your corn muffin batter or in a hoe cake batter or something like that.
Okay.
I wouldn't use it, though, for anything you want to puff. So like croissants or puff pastry, or even if you do scones and you like do that thing where you fold them so that it puffs a little bit, I wouldn't necessarily do that because there's not enough water in the chicken fat.
Okay.
I mean, I love the idea that you use it for sauteing vegetables because, you know, it gives it that really savory flavor. I would say something else I would suggest you playing with is you take a bunch of onions, dice them or slice them, slowly cook the onions in a bunch of it. Use more fat than onions, maybe like 2-to-1 fat to onions, right? And you do it at a low temperature. You can, and when the onions are really soft, you can go all the way and caramelize them if you want. But even once they just soften and get really nice and translucent, just sweat them down, put in a little salt, and then let it cool for a little bit. And I would blend it in a blender. And then when you let that cool, it's the most delicious spread on hot toast.
That sounds
yummy. Really, really amazing. Or I would think about using it in other sort of savory ways that you would use butter, like if you were making pasta, if you sometimes finish the pasta with butter in the sauce or butter in the pasta, just use a spoonful of the chicken fat, and it gives you that same luxurious shine and that same richness, but it has, you know, its own flavor. There's also a book I would suggest you check out by the writer Michael Ruhlman, R-U-H-L-M-A-N, and he did a whole book on schmaltz. So schmaltz, I think, is the Yiddish word for chicken fat. And he has a whole book of ideas and recipes on what to do with it, and he's a great cook.
Wow. Well, thank you. That's some great ideas.
Great. Have fun. Take care.
Okay. Yeah, you too. Bye.
Always feel free to call us at 1-800-537-5252 or find us on Facebook or Twitter. In 2001, the Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom declared that chicken tikka masala was a national dish of Great Britain. It was a great moment for multiculturalism, even though you might note that colonialism in South Asia left something to be desired. And, of course, the unkind joke is that if the British had anything good to eat at home, maybe they wouldn't have gone all the way to India. But, you know, global politics aside, things have changed. London is now arguably one of the best cities in the world for eating, not just for its cultural diversity, but also for the city's chefs. Alexandra Crapanzano has eaten through all of it, and she talked with the New York Times columnist Melissa Clark about the four London chefs she thinks changed everything.
Alexandra, so great to have you here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So why does British food have such a bad reputation, even now?
Well, it shouldn't anymore. But it still does. I think it really has to do with the fact that for, you know, 1,000 years practically, the reputation was that you ate aged mutton and boiled vegetables, vegetables boiled down to, you know, a kind of gray pulpy mass that was just really, really revolting. And that that reputation, because I think it was so graphic, really stuck. Desserts, however, were always amazing. Baked goods were always amazing. Scones and clotted cream and steamed puddings and Bakewell tarts. And that was, I think, where British food for so long was at its most delicious. But when you went to the cities and went to restaurants, the food really was terribly bland and very stuffy. It was either on the very kind of stuffy formal level or the very casual curry house, quick meal level.
So it was either you went to the Savoy or you went to a curry house.
Exactly. And there was very, very little in between.
And so when did all this begin to change?
I feel that it really began to change in the 80s with a couple very important key players. Terence Conran, who many of us think of almost more for his work in design, opened Bibendum in 1987, which is a restaurant in Chelsea that was famously known for a beautiful stained glass window of the Michelin man, the Michelin tire man, and it had been that factory originally. And he really loved the very simple food of Elizabeth David, French Provençal food, Italian food, and he wanted to take the simplicity of that food and bring it to London and also to break down the kind of heavy decorations that were so common in fancy British restaurants. So he really kind of pared things down enormously so that there were, you know, the room was filled with natural light and the plates were white and food was kind of simply prepared and simply plated and it wasn't fussy. And therefore, people were able to have a lot of fun.
And Elizabeth David, she was one of the most important food writers in England, right?
Elizabeth David was an enormously important food writer. She published Mediterranean Cooking in 1950.
So in addition to Conran, who were the other two big influencers? You mentioned there were three.
Yes, absolutely. One of them is actually two, which is Ruthie Rogers and Rose Gray. Rose Gray, unfortunately, died a couple years ago. But they started also in the late 80s a restaurant called the River Cafe, which is still absolutely thriving and delicious. And the River Cafe is an Italian restaurant. It is on the river, and it is quite different from other restaurants in London and was very groundbreaking then. And the space itself, which was designed by Ruth Rogers' husband, Richard Rogers, who was the designer of the Pompidou Center in Paris and Lloyd's of London, is really an architectural masterpiece. The other person is Fergus Henderson, who pioneered what we call nose-to-tail cooking. He actually started as an architect, and he opened St. John Food and Wine as a chef and really believed in eating all of the animal. He believed it was actually only polite if you were going to kill an animal to eat all of it. And so while he does serve lots of strange ingredients, he actually also serves really beautiful, hearty British food, but prepared in a way that is, I wouldn't say modern, but it is so perfectly crafted. It's as though he has taken the best of French technique and combined that with a British tradition.
Now, these three are at the roots of what you call the London culinary trees. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So when I started researching, I quickly noticed that many of the really good young chefs had trained at either St. John Food and Wine with Fergus Henderson, or the River Cafe with Ruthie Rogers, or had trained with Simon Hopkinson of Bibendum, which was Terence Conran's restaurant. And so I was seeing these incredible links between people, and I was seeing almost a brotherhood and a sisterhood among chefs, which is very rare, I think, an immense solidarity and appreciation for each other, as well as a shared belief in seasonal ingredients, sustainability, craft, all of these things. And what I discovered was that Fergus Henderson and Ruthie Rogers are both not only great chefs, but they're also really at heart teachers, and that they had shepherded an entire generation of really good cooks and mentored them. So many of the really good chefs cooking today in London had trained at one of those two restaurants, if not both.
Now, if you were going to send someone to one restaurant, they just have one night in London, where would you send them? I know this is hard.
That is really hard. I mean, I would probably say the River Cafe is a place that everybody should go to once. But I also would say that about St. John Food and Wine and, and Nopi. And there's a wonderful Moorish restaurant owned by Sam and Sam. They're both named Sam, husband and wife, Clark, which I also think is fantastic. So, no, I can't break it down to one.
Well, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure, Melissa. Thank you.
Alexandra Crapanzano is author of The London Cookbook. Melissa Clark's new book is Dinner, Changing the Game. Now, Alexandra left us with a recipe for roasted corn and chorizo chowder. Find it at splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. It was great to have you with us. And until next time, I wish you good food on the table and good people around it. David Leet of Leet's Culinaria is guest hosting next week, and he's talking to Dr. Drew Ramsey about how what we eat affects our brain health. So don't miss that. If you like what you heard here today, subscribe to our podcast. And, as always, you can find more information about everything you heard at splendidtable.org. You also find a new video on the website this week. We've been talking about food from faraway places, so we posted a video about kolaches, the Central European pastry that's thriving in Central Texas. Take a look at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell, with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lutke. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer, and Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.